from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, there is a crisis in Mexican journalism stemming from threats against journalists by members of organized drug cartels. A number of Mexican journalists have been killed or disappeared as criminal drug organizations have expanded their power, and the spread of violence has increased, especially along the U.S.-Mexican border, where President Felipe Calderon has deployed nearly 50,000 troops. So how bad is it? And are the stories that need to be told being told? And is the drug violence spilling over into the United States? We'll have a panel discussion, include your calls and emails, next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. With the government of Felipe Calderon fighting drug trafficking in Mexico, a quarter of the Mexican army is presently committed to the ongoing drug war. And the growing violence associated with criminal organizations in Mexico has made it one of the world's deadliest countries for reporters. This week, professional journalists meet at Stanford and Santa Clara universities to discuss the dangers of reporting on the increasingly violent Mexican drug trade. And in this Forum Hour, we focus our attention on the Mexican drug trade and the fate of journalists who work to cover it. Let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. Joel Simon, is here in studio. He is executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, a former reporter in Mexico. Good morning.
Great to be here.
Good to have you here. And Ricardo Sandoval also joins us, president of the Society for Professional Journalists, Northern California chapter, and assistant city editor of the Sacramento Bee, former foreign correspondent in Latin America covering crime, migration, and insurgent movements. And welcome to you. Good morning.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Glad to have you. We also have with us by phone this morning Alfredo Corchado, who is part of the Mexican Bureau of the Dallas Morning News, currently a Nieman Fellow. He joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. And welcome, Alfredo Corchado.
Pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Dudley Althaus, who is bureau chief in Latin America for the Houston Chronicle and joins us this morning from Mexico City. Welcome, Dudley Althaus.
Hola.
Hola. Buenos dias. Let me begin, actually, Joel Simon, with you. I read the report that was put out by your organization, the Committee to Protect Journalists, and we're talking about things being so dangerous in Mexico. This is a report essentially on just how impunity works in these different countries. Here's Mexico between, it's kind of hard for many people to grasp this, Pakistan and Bangladesh. I mean, it's that bad. It's like a war zone, really.
It's exactly like a war zone. And the level of violence against the press in Mexico, I mean, you have to put it in context. There's generalized violence in Mexico, but journalists are being targeted. And the numbers that we recorded in Mexico would be typical of a war zone. And yet, Mexico obviously is not at war. So it's a very alarming situation. The result is widespread self-censorship. The result is that vital stories aren't being covered. The result is that fear is dictating the journalistic agenda in Mexico.
It is, in fact, the toughest beat right now anywhere in this hemisphere.
I think that, you know, Cuba is, you know, on a kind of a different level. Cuba is the second leading jailer of journalists, and obviously there's no free press there. But if you're talking about the rest of Latin America, you could look at Colombia. There are obviously enormous challenges there. Brazil. But Mexico, I really think at this point, is probably the most dangerous beat in all of Latin America.
It's what's amazing about it is, as I believe you've pointed out, there be, say, gun battles in the street and people be killed and it wouldn't be reported
yeah,
in the daily newspaper.
Absolutely. There have been many such incidents of that nature. It's a kind of apocryphal tale at this point. You hear about that sort of thing in a number of different cities. Or if they are reported, it's very rudimentary. It'll be from a press release. It'll be based on one official source. But it's really reached the point in which a gun battle can take place and people can be killed and you won't necessarily read about that in your newspaper.
So because of all this self-censorship and because of this difficulty getting the story out and because really of the kind of control of drug cartels, you're trying to get President Obama involved, that is your organization is?
Yeah, well, this has now become an issue which is a fundamental threat to Mexican society. And it's broader than just the press. It's about freedom of expression. It's about the ability of Mexicans to communicate with each other, to be informed about the challenges that the country faces. And essentially, the drug cartels are dictating the media agenda. They are determining what is and is not covered. And that's got to be on pretty high on the agenda, certainly in Mexico, but as part of the binational discussions.
Well, in Mexico, you've been behind a constitutional amendment to give federal authorities more power.
Well, what we want is the federal government needs to step in and make it a federal crime to inhibit the free exercise of free expression. It's kind of like the civil rights movement in the United States. In other words, this is a fundamental right which Mexicans are not able to exercise. The federal government must step in and take measures to ensure that people can speak freely.
Joel Simon, again, is executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, former reporter in Mexico, and Ricardo Sandoval, also with us in studio this morning, is president of the Northern California chapter of Society of Professional Journalists, assistant city editor of the Sacramento Bee, and former correspondent in Latin America, covering crime, migration, and insurgent movements. And I suppose one of the things that has to be pointed out right away, Ricardo, is the fact that things changed when the PRI, dominant party of over nine decades, was moved out and democracy was moved in.
And that's exactly right. I think in the old days, people looked at the situation in Mexico with the relationship between the government and some of the drug cartels as a somewhat peaceful or agreeable coexistence. There's always accusations that the government was basically running the show hand in hand with the cartels, which is one of the reasons why back in the old days it was thought that the PRI, the former ruling party, could keep a lid on things.
Well, they were bribing and yes. Corruption, I mean, was unbelievable.
Yes,
too.
Yes. And so you remove that that lid from this boiling pot, and of course you're going to have a lot of bubbling over, which has been occurring over the last few years now.
How bad is this problem? I mean, in the sense of, you talk about bubbling over, I was reading some articles out of Texas newspapers. They said the coverage here is exaggerated. It's not as extreme. It's not, you know, I mean, and then you read on the other hand, the Mexican cartel, drug cartel is in 200-some American cities. I mean, how do we sort this out?
It's bad. I mean, by comparison, it's bad. In the old days, for example, you could go to Tijuana. I was born in Tijuana, so my family, I would go almost every week when I lived and was growing up in San Diego. Today, my family who lives on the border will not cross the border. They refuse to go into Tijuana. It's for this fear of being caught up as bystanders in some of this violence. Now, obviously, if you go to other cities and even parts of larger cities like Guadalajara and Mexico City, you can avoid these situations. You probably won't run into this kind of stuff unless you're looking for it.
And the tourist places seem to be
by and large.
Free, by and large.
Although Acapulco is a bit problematic these days as well.
What about the spillover there to the north?
The spillover, I think, you know, we are seeing an increased level of activity on this side of the border by the cartels. But I got one thing I need to say, and I feel like it's been, I'm not going to say overblown, but there has been activity by Mexican drug dealers in the United States for decades now. When I was growing up in San Diego, and I was a teenager in San Diego, I knew some kids who were being recruited to run drugs for Mexican traffickers, and they would take drugs into the American Midwest. This was in the late 70s. So it's been going on for some time. What we're seeing now is perhaps a ratcheting up of this sense of, I'm not going to say impunity, but yes, maybe impunity, or the sense that some of these dealers perhaps think they can get away with a little bit more on this side of the border.
Well, I was actually alluding to some of the spillover that was supposedly into El Paso from Juarez, and a lot of what was described in some of the Texas newspapers I was reading as media feeding frenzy and using for politics and so forth. So, like I say, sometimes it's hard to get a hold on that particular elusive topic, but it does seem profoundly scary about what's going on there. In fact, you had an incident. Well, you've had a few incidents, but you were covering the killing of women in Juarez, and you had one of these goons come up to you, I guess. Huh?
Well, Alfredo did, and he's had that on more than one occasion. I was with him once when one of our people who helped us with the stories out of Juarez indicated to us that Vicente Carrillo Fuentes was upset with the stories, and he's the head of the Juarez cartel. And that gives you a little bit of a sinking feeling in your gut to know that you've upset the chief of one of the largest cartels in Mexico.
Now, we'll talk actually about that with Alfredo, but I wanted to also get a sense from you about just what's happening with respect to journalism. Joel Simon said a lot more self-censorship. Also, the bureaus aren't there like they used to be.
And that's a strong point. We were talking before the show and realizing that of the California newspapers, for example, I can't think of a newspaper outside of the Los Angeles Times that has a full-time correspondent or set of correspondents in Mexico or Latin America these days. And that's quite a scale down from 1997 when I first went to Mexico for the San Jose Mercury News. San Diego had correspondents down there. The Mercury News, even Sacramento Bee had a correspondent down there. And the Los Angeles Times. Now it's just the Times. So you see this peeling back of the population of American journalists in Latin America, that can't be good. Eventually, it's going to have an impact. It already has, I believe, had an impact on the level of information that the public is getting in the U.S. Thank goodness that the L.A. Times and the Washington Post have made
this story
a priority over the last couple of years.
So why are you optimistic? You've said you're optimistic. Why?
I'm optimistic because there is, in its place, there's a great population of young journalists who are venturing abroad now for things like the Global Post. Even as freelancers, they're venturesome. They're taking it upon themselves to go report these stories. And as the internet develops itself into a more viable source of credible, good, in-depth reporting, we're going to find more homes for this kind of reporting from abroad.
Aren't there a lot of reporters coming in from Colombia, too, who are at least helping to some extent to get at this story? They've certainly been veterans in these drug stories.
Yeah, and you know, and the great thing about that is that there's a great level of, in English, it's interchange or intercambio, as you say in Spanish, but we're able to help each other out a lot more these days.
Carlos Sandoval, again, former foreign correspondent in Latin America, who covers crime, migration, and insurgent movement, or did now is with the Sacramento Bee as assistant city editor. Well, Alfredo Cachardo, let's bring you into this. And Alfredo Cachardo is with the Mexican Bureau of the Dallas Morning News, but now in Cambridge as a Nieman Fellow, a native of Mexico. That story about that guy saying to you, what, the FBI can't protect everybody? I mean, tell us about it.
Well, that incident actually happened in Laredo, of all places, which I think was, to me, the biggest surprise because it happened on the U.S. side. In short, what happened there was I was covering the movement of the paramilitary group known as the Zetas, who are the armed forces of the cartel in the state of Tamaulipas, known as the Gulf Cartel. And I was I'd been covering them that same day. I was I had done a couple of interviews with a couple of U.S. sources, and that evening, as I'm sitting at a bar in Laredo, Texas, I guess the short version of the story: this guy comes up to me and essentially hands me over a tequila and says, "You know, it's great that." That you're here. It's great that people are still coming into Laredo. As you can see, it's a peaceful city. We have beautiful women. We have beautiful atmosphere. Blah blah blah. The problem is that is when people start asking too many questions, like who are the Zetas, how do they operate, who are they killing, etc. And then he went into great detail describing what would happen to me if I didn't stop doing that. And
was this also kind of he put his arm around you and was reacting real palsy? Smiling.
Yeah, I put his arm around me. My first reaction when he came over and was very positive about Laredo was I thought he was from the Chamber of Commerce there. when he started describing a barrel and pouring, acid over me and videotaping the incident to send it back to my parents in Texas, that's when I knew this was a message.
Yeah, in fact, I think you said that there was a young kid who had an acid injected into his heart. This was, not to get too graphic here, but from your perspective, this was like when the cartel started crossing the Rubicon, when they became, no more. It's like, Cosa Nostra used to have certain rules. You didn't kill members of the family's family and all that sort of thing. And then they started violating those rules, that kind of thing.
Right. I mean, that's kind of when we started seeing a new kind of violence in Mexico. The barrels, the acid, the beheadings, et cetera. It was a new reality for the press and also for the people who live there in Mexico.
And there's a terrible incident recently in Alabama, and they tied it to a Mexican drug cartel. I mean, there was obviously a warning because there was some puncturing of all kinds of organs and slashing. And again, one doesn't want to get into too graphic detail here, but it's pretty horrible. And a lot of this, I think, as you pointed out, Alfredo, sort of stems from special forces training. I mean, a lot of these guys are trained by the military initially, aren't they?
Well, there was a small group of soldiers, Mexican soldiers, who were trained back in the 90s by the military, U.S. military. They were known as the GAFES. They went back to Mexico, and the goal was to take on cartels to be the enforcers. The way the story goes, the head of the GAF cartel went up to some of the members and said, you know, how much are you getting paid? We quoted him a price. He said, I'll double it or triple it. Plus, I'll give you a certain percentage of the distribution routes. And lo and behold, 35 members took up the offer and thus became the group known as the Zetas.
And from your perspective, there's this old notion that if you're an American journalist, you're less likely to have violence visited upon you, or to put it in the everyday terms, get whacked. But you and Ricardo, being brown skin and being of Mexican descent, sort of fall into a different category, do you?
Well, I didn't think that. I always thought that, you know, being an American allowed me certain privileges or certain protection. And it was really covering organized crime in Mexico that, I guess, you know, woke me up, if you will. I was, after the second or third threat, the paper sent me to a training program at the State Department in Washington. And it was interesting that most of the people who were there were on their way to Baghdad. I think my colleague, Angela Cochariga, and myself were the only journalists from Mexico. After 3 days of training, after the training, I went up to talk to one of my sources, and I said, no, I think I feel good about this. I'm ready to go back to Mexico. I'm ready to go back to the story. And after a while, the guy says, you know, I have good news and bad news for you. Good news is, yes, you're an American journalist. No one wants to mess with American journalists because it's a $30 to $40 billion industry, and it'll disrupt it's bad for business. Bad news, you don't look American. So I was asked to, recommended that I wear all my credentials outside and you know, make sure I tell everybody I'm an American journalist.
Wrap yourself in the stars and stripes or something like that.
Short of walking around with a flag around
you. Yeah, walking around with a flag around you. Alfredo Corchado, again, is with us this morning from Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he's currently a Nieman Fellow. He is with the Mexican Bureau for the Dallas Morning News and a native of Mexico. Dudley Althaus is Bureau Chief in Latin America for the Houston Chronicle. He joins us this morning from Mexico City. And we're talking, Dudley Althaus, about all of this self-censorship and all the problems that accrue for journalists down there. But you've said that some of the big national papers in Mexico City are doing a good job, and Proceso, the left-leaning magazine, has done a good job on this.
Yeah, I think they have. I think there is a lot of information getting out. What happens a lot in the provinces is smaller papers that are actually operating and being published in the towns where these guys are, have done a lot of self-censorship in the sense that you don't read names of who's behind certain killings or that sort of thing. They don't get into too many details, which I think is very dangerous. But the national press, I think, has done a fairly good job. I rely on them. It's a big country. And Proceso, I think, has done a very good job.
That's dangerous for foreign journalists, though. I mean, as much as it is for Mexican journalists. I know you wanted to do a story in Dorado about a local political boss tied to a cartel, and you felt some apprehension and hesitation, to put it mildly, huh?
Yeah, I think if you're around a lot, Alfredo has been covering the border very intensely, and I think he's there a lot, and they've got to know him much better. I think for a national, like a roving correspondent here, somebody that pops in and pops out, it's less dangerous, but it has had a chilling effect. You think twice or three times about going into especially rural towns to do a story on, say, a local local political boss or a local who might be a drug dealer. I was just in Durango, and there is a chilling effect. In Durango, it doesn't get reported much, but there's been an enormous amount of kidnappings and disappearances of people. And so you think two or three times before going into some of those villages because the guys are there.
What about just not using your byline?
You know, people do that. The Mexican press has started doing that. I don't see where that's really a protection, especially for local newspapers. Pretty much everybody knows who's writing the story anyhow. You know, the sources know who just called them. I suppose it gives some sort of an ear of it protection, but it seems to me like the old the dye they used to give aviators in World War II who had to ditch in the ocean for anti-shark dye or something, which didn't work at all. It's just more like a security blanket. I think. I think for local journalists, if you're reporting on this stuff for local Mexican journalists, I think you're in danger anyhow. I think the fact that they're still reporting on this, especially in the provincial papers, really suggests a level of bravery of some of these reporters.
Yeah, no, immense amount of courage. I would second that or echo that. Yet a lot of these stories that aren't being covered, I mean, nevertheless, are seeping out. Stories about smuggling of guns into Mexico, stories about drugs going across the border one way or the other. I think you kind of summed it up in a way that seems to make a good deal of sense, that Mexico isn't so much a failed state. What we have is a failed justice or law and order system.
It's an extremely failed law and order system. I mean, they are – this is – to me, this is the biggest test of Mexico's post – one-party system. It's a multi-party system that's working towards a full democracy. This is a huge test for that. You have all kinds of different and competing powers between local, state, and federal governments that didn't exist before. They just kind of like worked through those. It's always been in the Constitution, the separation of powers, but when Mexico was a one-party system, that was just kind of like, you know, the formal system, and everything else was worked out through the party bureaucracy. And now you have competing powers, and in a lot of cases just get, you know, fall through the cracks in a lot of the justice. And it gives a lot of people cover for passing the buck. So, yeah, the system, I think, is extremely vulnerable, and that's really affecting people here.
Is there a sense that President Calderon is really making much headway with this? I mean, like I said earlier on, he's got 50,000 troops mobilized at the border. I mean, he's got an immense amount of what exists in the military there out fighting this drug war, about a third, in fact, of the military.
Well, to me, where the troops are and where the federal police have really cracked down, say, like in Juarez at the moment, I mean, they have almost a full division worth of federal police and army troops in Juarez, a city of 1 million people, 1.3 million. It's under army occupation. And the crime, the murders have gone way down. There's still a large number of murders in the city, despite all the troops. But the troops can't be everywhere. I did a story about a month ago in Durango again, where some very small villages actually had built moats around the village to protect themselves from rampaging bands that were coming in to kidnap people. Now, these are rural farm villages. The moats didn't work, but the villagers were told by the army to build the moats because the army couldn't be there.
We're coming up on a break here, so let me give out the phone number. Let me just say, you know, that with the recession, the number of undocumented coming over the borders has decreased, but there are people who are coming over the border just because they need to feel safe. I mean, things are pretty bad. And we want to hear from you. If you'd like to join this conversation, we welcome your involvement. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or SiriusXM satellite, feel free to join the program, 866-733-6786, or send an email, forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This week, professional journalists are meeting at Stanford and Santa Clara University to talk about the dangers of reporting on the drug trade in Mexico, which is what we're talking about in this hour. Journalists are under fire, self-censoring, and the concern for physical safety and the intensity of the violence associated with the drug cartel in Mexico has simply escalated, and escalated to a point where it's gotten really out of control. We were talking off air about the fact that even in the Ricardo Sandoval was saying in the local areas, the authorities simply, the police authorities don't have the authority, and they don't really have the resources. And Joel Simon was saying when you send in the troops, you know, you get the kind of thing that you've seen here in the United States. That is the military trying to act like police, and often that presents real difficulties as well. So we are going to go to your calls here. I want to just remind those of you who are interested in the events that I alluded to at Stanford and Santa Clara. It'll be 6 p.m. Tomorrow evening, April 23rd, at Santa Clara University, and 1 p.m. Friday on the 24th of April at Stanford University. And let me remind you that we're talking by phone to Alfredo Corchado, who is with the Mexican Bureau of the Dallas Morning News, joining us this morning from Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he is currently a Nieman Fellow. He's a native of Mexico. And also with us by phone this morning from Mexico City, Dudley Althaus, who is Bureau Chief in Latin America for the Houston Chronicle. Our guests in studio are Ricardo Sandoval, president of the Society of Professional Journalists, Northern California chapter, and assistant city editor of the Sacramento Bee, former foreign correspondent in Latin America, and Joel Simon, executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. By the way, let me give out their website, Society for Professional Journalists. If you want more information about this, you can simply go to SPJ NorCal, that is the Northern California chapter that Ricardo Sandoval is president of, and it's spjnorcal.org. And we are going to go to your calls. Let me go to our first caller, Jorge. Good morning.
Oh, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I've listened to you the past few days, and by now we all already know that Mexico is a major drug, you know, producing and transitory country, and is the main foreign supplier to marijuana and methamphetamine to the United States. We know of the violence, and one of the things I would like to ask your panelists, because we're talking about journalism that are going in Mexico. Recently, I read a report on the LA Times about a journalist coming into the United States and asking for political asylum. He was claiming that he was being persecuted by the Mexican army, and the State Department was afraid that this was going to become a widespread problem of Mexicans asking for political asylum in massive numbers because of the violence in Mexico. So I would like them to comment on that. And one more thing I would like to say about the violence in Mexico, something that seemed to not be reported, is that the fact that the government is taking off so many heads of cartels is creating a power vacuum within these cartels, and the violence is really between them and not necessarily the cartels against, you know, civilians or the government.
It's increased the competition, certainly. Yeah. Jorge, thank you for that call. Let me ask Joel Simon, do you know the case, the asylum case you mentioned?
Yeah, I think this is the case of Emilio Gutierrez, who's a journalist who was reporting in Juarez. His house was raided by the Mexican military. He, fearing for his life, went to the United States and asked for asylum, and his asylum is being processed. This is that the threats and the notion of crossing the border and trying to escape some of this, the pressure, that is happening. Political asylum is very, very unusual. It's very difficult for a Mexican to get political asylum in the United States, so it's a very unusual case.
Kelly joins us next. Kelly, good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling. My husband was a lawyer and officer in the Mexican Navy. I'm a U.S. citizen, but I lived with him in Ensenada, Baja California for 2 years. And before President Felipe Calderon took over, we had problems with a depressing economy and random kidnappings and general insecurity. But once he did take over and he deployed the military to essentially police the corrupt police and fight the narcos, we had even more problems. And I myself am a journalist. I worked as a journalist in Mexico. And regardless of the fact that I'm an American and I'm pale-skinned, etc., I never felt more secure than any of the Mexican journalists because there's no protection in that country. There's no way of keeping yourself safe because there's so much corruption and so many people that have been bought up by the narcos and you don't know who they are. So there's it's a very depressing situation, and eventually my family and I had to flee Mexico. So
there it is. Thank you for that brief but compelling narrative that you just gave us. Want to comment, Ricardo Sandoval?
You know, that's you hear that often now, and you hear people talking about the Mexico that was and the Mexico that is. Even Tony Garza, the former U.S. ambassador to Mexico, indicated that his family, the border family, is reluctant to travel into Mexico anymore these days. And that is there, and it's something that's it's palpable.
Reminds me a little bit when I was in Spain and I was talking to cab drivers and they were saying, boy, it was better under Franco. We didn't have the problem with drugs that we have now. You know, I mean, unfortunately, with the PRI, there weren't these problems.
Yeah, and you look back on the time, there was always the corruption. And unfortunately, in sectors of the Mexican government, especially in the local level, I would say it's almost systemic. When people asked before, is Mexico going to be a failed state? Is it going to be a narco state, much like Colombia was for a long time? The answer was always traditionally no, because Mexico has stronger institutions, perhaps more independent civic institutions. But I think you've seen a crumbling of that over the last decade. I mean, I don't know what the rest of the guys think, but I've seen these institutions that in the past were staunchly civic-minded, there's been a deterioration, even within the military.
Let me go to a couple emails here before. Yeah, go ahead. Jump in here.
I want to get
Alfredo Corchado.
I want to get back to what I think was a good point that that Jorge made, the caller, and that is that as bad as things are right now, and I mean there's more than 10,000 people killed since Calderon took office, as bad as it looks, it's going to get a lot worse because we really haven't seen it's not really a war yet. I mean, we keep calling it a drug war, but it's not really a war in the sense that it's the cartels taking on the military. I mean, with very few exceptions, you haven't seen the cartels taking on the barracks or targeting, you know, checkpoints of soldiers. You hear isolated cases, but it really hasn't. It's not a full blown thing, and that's why when you talk to Mexican officials, they will tell you very quietly, you know, things will get worse, and I mean that's exactly what they're referring to. I'd be curious to see if Dudley feels the same way.
Well, Dudley, you want to go on record here?
I think it could very well get worse. I think, in fact, most of the victims have been somehow related to the drug trade or have been public security forces so far. But there's a silent epidemic as well of extortions, of kidnappings, of disappearances of people. Scores, maybe hundreds of people have been simply disappeared, picked up, either kidnapped for ransom or just disappeared because they're somehow involved in the trade or they got crosswise with someone. And nothing's being done about that. Very little is being done about that at the state and local and even federal level. I think whereas most of this stuff has been contained to the drug smuggling industry, I think it puts everybody in danger, crossfires and just a general level of insecurity. I like the lady caller who just called in and used to live in Ensenada. I agree. I think everybody is kind of in danger. There's a general feeling of insecurity that's just popped up. I think it was kind of latent under the one-party system where it was almost a Potemkin village of public security. And the fact that now the government's like cracking down in some respects has just kind of like opened this tremendous box of pestilence that is affecting the people.
Yeah, Joel Simon, you wanted to add?
Yeah, I the other point I wanted to make is taking a sort of long-term view of what's happened in Mexico and why the violence has escalated. I mean, I think one of the problems is, as long as I've been following Mexico, which is two decades now, nobody really knows. The sort of prevailing theory was that the drug mafia was contained within the pre-party structure. But it was a very difficult story to report, and I don't think it's ever been conclusively demonstrated. But I disagree somewhat with Ricardo. I don't think Mexico ever had the institutions. Colombia, in fact, when the cartels began to challenge the government directly for power, when you had, you know, Pablo Escobar in the Congress, that's when the government reacted, and it still had some institutional capabilities. Mexico doesn't really have the institutional capacity to push back against the cartels, which are now, in my view, directly confronting the government and challenging their authority.
Well, a couple of things. That impunity report that your organization put out, the figure was as high as 90% of crimes going unpublished. Was that any better under the PRI?
No.
Not brought to justice?
I think Dudley is absolutely right. I mean, but I think you can make that statement about most Mexican institutions. The judiciary is essentially non-functional. Almost all crimes go unprosecuted, including crimes against journalists. That's why the impunity rate is so high.
I think the difference back then, though, is that it was somewhat more orderly.
Yeah.
There was a sense of order to it all. There was even among the cartels, there was a so-called federation where these guys, the capos, the heads of the cartels would meet or would they'd come together and they'd sign off on agreements respecting territories. And so there was a sense of order.
Yeah, the phrase that comes to mind now is the antithesis of that. Right out of Milton's Paradise Lost is like chaos and old night,
right,
as opposed to order. We got a caller in Brownsville, Texas. Raul, good morning.
Good morning. Enjoying the show. Thank you for taking my call. Quick comment and a question. I get the sense that people are saying that the Mexican government isn't doing enough, but how about giving them praise for actually standing up to these guys? My wife and I travel at least four times a year to the state of San Luis Potosí, and we've noticed there's a lot more military checkpoints, and as an American who gets to travel throughout the country with no checkpoints, it's kind of unnerving. But at the same time, it's reassuring that they're actually trying to do something. And my question is, has there been any kind of numbers put out as far as the economic impact, as far as the tourism that Mexico has lost, as far as the money coming into the country from tourists and college students and stuff like that?
It's a good question. Anybody have any data on that? Do you, Ricardo?
I don't know about data. Maybe Alfredo and Dudley might have, since they're down there and can touch on it a lot more.
There's definitely been a diminution of tourists.
Yes. I mean, even in this last spring break period, there were reports, widespread reports, Cancun and certainly Acapulco, and especially in Baja, which feeds off of the California universities. In Rosarito and Ensenada, the hotels were empty.
Of course, that's the recession, too, I'm sure, contributing to that.
There was a lot of publicity about this whole situation prior to this current spring break. I think it had an effect.
What do you think, Dudley Althaus?
Well, the government has reported that actually tourism income was up at this past quarter compared to last year.
There you go.
Slightly. But there was a drop in spring breakers and everything else, especially the Cancun into Baja California and Acapulco. The callers from the border, the Texas-Mexico border in Brownsville, I used to work there. I think border cities, the Mexican border cities economy that depended on tourists have gotten creamed. Nuevo Laredo is a good case in point. The violence there has calmed down considerably in the past 2 years. I think they're still suffering. They're still, once you get a reputation for being a violent town, people stop coming. I think that's unfortunate. I don't know if that should stop people from reporting what's going on. As far as the violence.
Let me go to some of your emails. Alfredo Cochero, here's a listener named Eric who says, wouldn't the border fence inhibit the flow of weapons and cash from the U.S. to Mexico? Shouldn't Mexico chip in to support the cost of its construction? Shouldn't one expect more support for the border fence within Mexico?
Well, actually, the Mexican ambassador was just up at Harbor a few weeks ago, and he actually went on and said that he supports the construction of a border fence to stop the flow of weapons. I thought he said that in tongue-in-cheek, but as I talked to him afterwards, he was dead serious about that. You do hear some Mexicans, I would say it's widespread, but you do hear some Mexicans, say, hey, we'll chip in. We'll put up the labor. You guys put up the material.
Another question from a listener, and maybe you can help us out here, Ricardo Sandoval. This is, please define cartel, and how many cartels exist?
Oh, boy, the broad definition of cartel. It's basically the country, Mexico, is divided into certain territories. And these cartels, operate on the west coast of Mexico along the
They're
Gulf
networks,
coast.
Enterprises, really.
Yes,
yeah.
And they run like enterprises. But the difference is that there's a lot of autonomy down below, and there's patronage paid upward. And that's where they make their billions of dollars. But they are very serious about maintaining their territory, and that's why we have the problems that we're having today.
And Dudley Althaus,
can I add something to that?
Yeah, go ahead.
There's actually a professor at the University of Texas at El Paso who's been,
Alfredo Corchado. Yeah.
He's been promoting the idea that instead of calling it the Juarez Cartel or the Tijuana Cartel, we ought to start calling it the Los Angeles Tijuana Cartel, the Dallas Goth Cartel, to show just how...
Transborder, you know, yeah.
One does not exist without the other. Yeah, I mean, you need two to tangle.
It's a symbiotic relationship, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly.
And Dudley Altos, here's a listener named Bonnie who says, how is this all affecting the border with Guatemala? I spent a bit of time there and know there are drug issues there, too.
Well, it's seriously affecting that border. The CETAs have been blamed for attacks inside Guatemala, just inside Guatemala in recent months, going in to try to take over the drug trade in Guatemala. As the pressure... Officials say as the pressure builds in Mexico against these drug organizations, they're going to move into Central America, which is even less capable of handling them than the Mexicans have been in the past. So, yeah, it's affecting quite a bit. Apart from that, there's a lot of human smuggling on the Guatemala-Mexico border. Central Americans heading to the United States are smuggled by different criminal organizations. And they've been kidnapped, even in Phoenix and stuff, they get kidnapped. But they've been kidnapped on that border. They're also subject to robberies and assaults by the MS-13 and other Central American gangs. So, yeah, it's quite a bit of trouble down there. In fact, just a few weeks ago, an immigration official was kidnapped in Tapachula down on the Mexican border with Guatemala. By human smuggling organization.
Ricardo Sandoval.
Just a quick note on the controversy over the fence between the U.S. and Mexico. One of the most prevalent ways or means by which drugs make it into the United States is actually through the actual border crossings. And unless it's changed radically in the last few years, historically the way most of the drugs would get through would be in small amounts tucked into any number of vehicles and people crossing the border, knowing full well that at the border checkpoints, inspections are only going to be made perhaps on one out of every 10 cars. And so there's a sense that they could lose a fair amount because they know other shipments are going to get through. And that has been a strong way of shipping drugs into the U.S., and no fence is going to stop that.
Again, Ricardo Sandoval is president of the Society of Professional Journalists, Northern California chapter. And let me go to more of your calls. Gary, let's get you on here. Good morning,
Thank
Gary.
You.
Hi.
Thank you. Good morning. I think we need to isolate this problem before it becomes even more tragic than it is. And I think that if we can reduce the human misery involved with assassinations and failed states... By allowing people to make their own choice about drug use and be able to get it in a safe and inexpensive manner, at the same time, divert a lot of our resources being spent to on law enforcement into drug prevention and good drug education, honest appraisal of drug use, it would reduce the scale of human misery, which is becoming... so extreme, it's sickening and dangerous for all of us. And I hope this comment is germane to your...
No, it is. In fact, Gary, thank you for that, because we're getting a number of people saying, you know, if you decriminalize or make drugs legal, you'll be able to ameliorate or at least to some extent vanquish the problem. In fact, I'm looking at an email from a listener named Dennis, listens to us, and Aguadilla, Puerto Rico, who says, obviously, if the U.S. demand for drugs goes away, the problem will go away. I suspect that the demand for drugs coincides with the loss of emotional support provided by full-time parents and the extended family, both of which are nearly extinct in the United States. I managed to get kind of two topics covered there in one comment. But, you know, we are talking about, Dudley Altos, a tremendous appetite as far as drugs on both sides of the border. I mean, you know, it's the problem that plagues us in this part of the world, and will continue to plague us until we get a hold of it in some way.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. The problem did start with U.S. demand, but now in recent years, say in the past 10 years, but especially in the past five, Mexico's internal drug use has just skyrocketed. And I think a lot of those killings of the past year and a half have actually been for retail drug trade in some of these cities. It's local gangs warring with each other for the retail drug trade as much as it is about smuggling to the United States. A colleague of ours, the NPR correspondent who used to work in Africa, made a really good point a while back. He said there was so much attention to blood diamonds back in the day, but nobody's talking about drugs as the blood diamonds of today.
Was this Jason Bobian?
Yes. I'm sorry?
Was this Jason Bobian?
Yes, it was.
Who
sure was.
Worked here for many years, yeah.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah, but the analogy of blood diamonds is certainly an apt one, isn't it?
I thought it was very good. I mean, I'm agnostic about legalizing drugs. I would agree that it would the drop in demand would certainly affect the violence going on, or the legalization of the drugs would certainly affect the level of violence going on. But beyond that, I think that people have to realize that if they use drugs, if they're using cocaine or something, there is a trail of bloodshed that goes all the way back into Colombia.
And we go to more of your calls. Richard from Novato, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, gentlemen. I just have a couple of questions. Unfortunately, my wife periodically visits TJ. She takes my three very young children into TJ to visit the grandmother.
I'm sorry, TJ is Tijuana? I've never heard it referred to as TJ.
Yes, as commonly known as TJ.
Yeah, well,
so anyway,
I'm not familiar with those common things, I guess. Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, I am absolutely horrified. I don't sleep when they're down there. I am just so worried about all the violence that's been taking place down there. And my fear is that they're being targeted. They can be targeted when they cross the border, and my children being abducted. You know, is that going on? And if so, what's my course of action in the event something like that happens?
Who wants to handle this question? Joel Simon, you
well,
look like
Well, I'll make a generalized comment, which is about the level of fear. I mean, most of the violence that you're seeing from the cartels is targeted violence. It's violence directed against rivals or the government, and certainly bystanders have been caught up in the violence, but they're not the primary target. But what I think is happening is that the cartels have a fairly sophisticated strategy of controlling the media agenda, and they have several ways of doing this, and they're successfully spreading fear. One is they buy journalists, they corrupt journalists, and they, you know, journalists sometimes, you know, openly work in the newsroom trying to direct coverage within certain publications. That's really very threatening to the media in general and to the public debate. The second is, of course, they kill journalists who cross the line and don't follow their instructions, or who reveal things that they don't want revealed. And then the third thing is this public use of terror, of hanging banners, of leaving dead bodies in the street, of burning people in acid, of decapitating people. And altogether, what is happening is that the public debate, the information, the awareness about this whole issue is being ceded to the cartels. And that is a very, very scary situation.
Let me come at the listener's question another way, though. Richard is asking out of concern for his wife. And Alfredo Corchado, there is a good deal of press here that suggests that, for example, American citizens have been kidnapped in countries like Colombia, certainly obviously in Iraq and in the Middle East. How widespread is that in Mexico as a kind of booming business that is take somebody and, you know, hold them for ransom?
Well, one of the problems is that oftentimes when Americans are kidnapped on the U.S. side, you don't see a lot of people going to the authorities to report that. There's always a debate in El Paso as to how many Americans are being, you know, taken from El Paso to Juarez, and you talk to certain agencies, and they will say, you know, so many. And then the local authorities will say, you know, it's not true at all. The local authorities are always much more concerned about keeping the positive image, keeping the investment coming. I know Nuevo Laredo, I think the numbers grew all the way to almost up to 80 Americans who were kidnapped or were taken into Nuevo Laredo. Now, the vast majority of these people were somehow tied to drug trafficking. It. There were some cases of people who were being kidnapped for ransom or for money. So getting a hard figures has always been, I think, the biggest challenge for journalists. You know, just how much of the kidnappings have taken place, how much is it for ransom, how much is it for because of their association with drug traffickers.
And again, Alfredo Corchado is with the Mexican Bureau for the Dallas Morning News. More of your calls. I'm sorry, did you have something, Doug Lealtos, to add on this?
Yeah, if I could jump in on the, sure, on the caller question. We get this a lot. I mean, I get a lot of emails from readers asking the same thing. I'm always very reluctant to give any sort of advice. I would be nervous. I would think in general that if somebody that's visiting one of the Mexican border cities on a day trip or a 2 days is not targeted. People usually that are kidnapped are people the kidnappers know or have been looking at for a while. Having said that, I'm very reluctant to say, you know, that's fine to cross into there. But, I don't worry about kidnapping when I'm in Juarez or other border cities.
Let's go to Ken quickly here. Ken, if you could.
Yeah, hi. There's an assumption that the military is somehow not corrupted, yet over 200 cases have been documented, incursions across the U.S. border by the Mexican military in support of drug traffickers and human traffickers. This has been reported on NBC, on Fox News, and yet no. So the big question is, there's an underlying assumption that flooding the area with Mexican military is good. Maybe they're helping the traffickers. How far up does the corruption reach?
Yeah, good point. Quick response, Joel Simon, on that?
I'll say that to Ricardo, I think.
Ricardo Sandoval, yeah.
I think, you know, if you look at the institutions, again, by comparison, the military has its problems, but it doesn't have the kinds of problems that, say, a local police force or even some of the state police forces have in Mexico. So still, the Mexican military remains the last line of defense right now.
Well, the conversation continues at Stanford Friday at 1 p.m. and at Santa Clara University tomorrow at 6 p.m. I want to thank our guests. Thanks to Ricardo Sandoval, former foreign correspondent in Latin America, president of the Society of Professional Journalists and assistant city editor of the Sacramento Bee. Thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Our thanks also to Joel Simon here in studio, executive director, Committee to Protect Journalists. Good morning. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
And thanks to Alfredo Corchado, Mexican Bureau of the Dallas Morning News, who joined us from Cambridge, currently a Newman Fellow there, and to Dudley Althaus, Bureau Chief in Latin America for the Houston Chronicle, who joined us from Mexico City. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.